got a crazy ass true story to tell. It could be funny or thrilling or creepy as hell. And when you speak, surely none will make a sound. And the world's going breathless when your true story comes around.
Welcome back to Your Best True Story, everyone. Today's episode is a little different than the typical format that we follow in that we are actually interviewing the February story winner, Rob Kidston. So this is not going to have new stories being played that have been called in, but it's just going to be a discussion with Rob, who, if you remember, called in a great story about a close encounter with a great white off the coast of Australia. I believe that's episode 6. If you want to look back, the title of the story is Great Whites, and you can check that out. This episode will be entirely talking to Rob about more of his experiences as a scuba diver and photographer around the world, everywhere from Japan, Australia, Bali, Indonesia. He's got some great stories, some insight, and hope you enjoyed the interview. And definitely keep in mind that if you submit your own story into us, we'll play it on the air. And then if you get the most votes, you'll not only win $250, but you'll be invited on the show to be interviewed as well. So we strongly encourage you to call in your story, give it a shot. It doesn't really matter what time of month that you call it in. We will play it eventually when we get to it. And then all you got to do is encourage people to vote for it. And you can win the $250 and get interviewed on the show to talk more about your experiences. And if you do want to send your story in, just keep in mind it's very easy to do going into the show notes of whatever podcast player you're listening to this on. You should be able to find the links, as well as going to the website yourbesttruestory.com. And probably the best way to do it, the easiest, is to use the SpeakPipe link that will allow you to directly record it off of your phone or laptop right there and then, and automatically email it over to us. So thanks a lot. Hope you enjoy the interview with Rob Kidston, and also check out more of his underwater photography through the links in the show notes as well. And without further ado, underwater photographer Rob Kidston. All right. Hey, Rob, how you doing?
Good. How you doing, Jim?
Good, good. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And as I mentioned in the intro, you are our story winner from February.
I did it! Yeah, I did it!
You called in a great story about the great white close encounter. And ended up winning the most votes for it in February. So we definitely appreciate you participating and glad to send you the prize money. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, thanks, Jim. I mean, I love talking about it. I love talking about, like, I'm like thinking to myself, what kind of other stories could I think of, or where, how did I get here? And I started thinking about, like, the shark thing, and I was like, oh yeah, that's that was actually a pretty big shark. So I was like, yeah, maybe I should call in.
Yep. Yeah. Any time I think you get anywhere close to seeing a great white in person, it's probably a good story. There's no way around it.
Oh yeah. I mean, when I actually took that trip, I was thinking to myself, all right, here we go. I'm going to go on the surface cage, and there's a surface cage and there's another cage. They'll take you all the way down to the bottom of the ocean. So when I first got in the cage on the surface one, I was like, what am I doing? This is crazy. Like it didn't hit me until I actually got in that surface cage.
Yeah.
And then I started getting like a little bit nervous. I'm just like, oh man, what is going on here? And then it's like my body and my mind kind of like realized, okay, you got to calm down. So I was just trying to relax, breathing real heavy. And then finally, once you get into it and you start relaxing a little bit, then it's like, all right, I can do this. This is no big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned it on the show that we played your story on, that I have got, like, I think I haven't got like a ton of phobias about things, but something to do with sharks freaks me out on like a primal level of being down in the water with them, because
I mean, I totally agree with you on that. First, it's not normal to breathe underwater, right? So you got this regulator, and you just got to get used to like breathing underwater when you're diving. And then you got to get used to like, okay, what am I doing? It's kind of like the old Quint story with Jaws.
Yeah.
Where he's like, he's talking with that marine biologist Hooper, and he's like, what is that? He's like, anti-shark cage. And then Quint's kind of like looking at him like, shark's in the water, cage is in the water, you're in the water. You know, it's kind of like one of those things. It's like, what am I doing?
It definitely, I can't imagine, even if you're the most comfortable person in the world at being underwater and in that environment, there's definitely got to be an aspect of it that always seems foreign, and just that you're, yeah, on some primal level, you're just like, I should not be down here
totally.
Yeah. Which, speaking of which, you mind real quick for people that aren't familiar with you and your work and everything, if you could kind of go into a little bit of a bio about yourself, just how you got into the underwater diving and what you've, because you've done, it looks like from your work online, you've done a tremendous amount of fascinating photography everywhere from Japan, Australia, Florida. I'm probably missing a few places, but maybe quick
what
rundown.
I've been underwater photographer since about 2013. And I was going back to school, and I went back to school for about 8 years. And I was like, it's a long time. And then I actually hooked up with this this company that I knew through graduate work, and they were going to take contracting work overseas. And there was some contracting jobs along the East Coast. And funny story, I was like, I'll do anything but Japan. And then they call me back and they go, hey, Rob, we got a job for you in Japan. I'm like, oh. Like, it's so far away. I wasn't even processing or even thinking about, like, okay, I'm going the other side of the world. Oh my God, this is so stressful. But what happened was I ended up taking the contract, and I didn't even understand where I was going to be living. Like, I just kept hearing Japan, and I'm like, it's so far away. And I ended up taking the job, and I was living actually. It didn't register until I actually got closer to actually the date when I was moving. I'm on an island in Okinawa, Japan, that's like just east of Taiwan. So it's 3.5-hour flight from Tokyo. So it's pretty remote.
Wow.
The island itself, I think, is like 70 miles long and only 7 miles wide. So it's not that big of an island. And so when I got there, I'm like, okay, I'm on a tropical island. I really like fish. I'm into all that stuff. I'm like, and I got dive certified, but I was like, you know, I'm going to go get a camera. So I got a camera, and I got like a refresher with a dive master. I'm like, I just want to get accustomed to actually getting in the water again with all my gear and stuff. Because like I said, it's not a natural feeling to actually breathing underwater.
Yep.
And that instinct of like, oh God, what am I doing? That kind of thing. So I got some gear and I got this camera and I got on the water, and I'll never forget this. It's my first dive. I get in the water and I'm actually diving with this little camera. And I think, you know, oh, this is a real elaborate setup. You know, I spent $1,000 on this. This is like real expensive high end stuff. And, you know, it turns out it's not, but that's another story we'll kind of get into. So I'm actually swimming. And on the left side of me, I have a squid that is actually following me and identifying me as something. He can't figure out what it is. And half of his body is actually completely changing color, while the other side that's not facing me is a completely different other shade of color.
Wow.
And at that point, I started thinking to myself, okay, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is actually something else. You know, there's some exotic stuff here with diving and all that stuff. And so I started getting into more and more of the photography stuff. And started thinking to myself, okay, I'm doing some local stuff, diving and stuff. But I thought to myself, I don't know a lot of people here. And if I want to actually get out and actually wait for someone to actually do something with, I might be waiting for a long time. So I better start looking up trips. And I actually took this trip, like a local trip. There was actually a flight down to another island, and it was with manta rays. Okay. And so I was, okay, it was a small chain of islands, and I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. So I actually, so I went there, and I talked with a guide there, and he's like, Rob, I think you're really gonna like going to Bali because they have a really good setup there in terms of like learning how to use cameras and all that stuff. So at the time, you know, I thought, you know, oh, I got it all figured out, the camera, I'll go there. And I went there. I remember, I'll never forget this. This is, I went to Bali, and I'm with my guide, and my guide's like, okay, pick up here. Here's a couple little fish. And there's like these other, there's like these little tiny fish that look like coral or look like sponges. They're called frogfish. Okay. And they look like sponges. And I'm trying to zoom in. I'm trying to get a photo of them, and my camera can't do it. Like, I just don't have the setup. I don't have the technology. I don't know how to use what I got. And I started thinking to myself, I really got to start learning how to do this if I'm going to actually do this more.
Yeah.
And so then I went down this rabbit hole of traveling. There's underwater photography workshops over there on the other part of the world where you can go and learn how to use your camera, maximize, and really get into lighting and all this other stuff. So that's where I kind of took off, and I kind of created KidstonPhotography.com. And Kidston Photography is basically, that's my last name. But the premise of it is that when you look at a photo, the photo is not nearly drawn in as much, I don't think, until you actually start telling people, like, how'd you get that or what that's all about? And then people kind of like, oh, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Or that's, kind of, that's a little more interesting. So I started thinking about like, okay, so I wonder if I took those images and I was able to create a book. And then if I took a book, then maybe people could visually look at the book and be able to be like, okay, maybe a book with the images can kind of go hand in hand, but it kind of talks about every image has a story.
Yep.
So that's really where I kind of took it in terms of website and trying to develop a website and then look at developing a book. And then we could actually look at, you know, expanding off of that. And if you had an image or something you could put on a wall, then you could actually tell someone where that image came from.
Yeah.
Kind of make it more than just a picture.
Yeah. That's a great idea. And the book, which is called Stories of the Ocean, that just came out, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was able to just launch that book, and it's amazing how like you think, oh, I can do a book, whip this up real fast,
yeah,
and then publish it. But it's like, no, if the easier it looks, the harder it is.
Yeah, always.
That's really what it comes down to. Oh, yep. Yeah. So
it is amazing. Pretty much anything and everything you do seems to follow that formula. If you are trying something new, there's always like 10 layers of complexity to it that you have no idea about until you actually try and do it.
That's the way I was with the camera. I was like thinking to myself, oh, I get this camera, I'll just point and shoot. You know, I got a little bit of light on it, no problem, no big deal. And then I started taking photos, and I'm like, this isn't coming out that well.
Yeah.
And then when I went to Bali, I started running into like people that were from other countries, and I started looking at some of their camera setups, and I'm like, wow, these are pretty elaborate. And there's a lot of thought that goes into this, and there's a lot. So I actually ended up getting another camera, and then I started getting with strobes, and then I started really trying to figure out how do I really know how to use this thing, or how do I know how to work this thing. And I went to a workshop in the Philippines, and I really started really learning how to use like manual settings with ISO, aperture, shutter speed, manipulating light, that kind of stuff. So to me, it was like really complex at first, and actually, I was just trying to just create one setting at a time. And then I actually went back and I started diving right outside my house in Japan. And it's basically built off a volcanic reef. So there's all this volcanic activity. And so it actually, all that volcanic activity kind of feeds off of coral. So the whole island is surrounded by coral. And so I was actually diving on some spots that were like not only 30 feet, but they would go out for like half a mile, 2 miles, just 30 feet. And I didn't realize that at certain times of the year, there's different things in the water. And you start getting in the water and you start realizing that, okay, different seasons for different types of things. So I actually got in the water one time and I started like venturing out a little bit more, trying to get a little more comfortable because you don't want to like go out too far because you don't know what's out there. And I started noticing these like really big like cuttlefish. And they start actually peeking around the corner looking at me. Then they go back. So I'm like, that's kind of weird. Never saw that before. Then I go back in, I go in the house, be done with my dive. Next time I go out, I'm like, I'm going to check that out again. So I go out there and I'd see them again. They're like looking around at me. They go back. So I'm like, every time I'd kind of venture out just a little bit further until I got to this point where there was like, there was probably at least 50 cuttlefish in the water. And what was happening was these cuttlefish are coming in from the depths at a certain time of the year. And they were actually bringing in, the males and females were coming in and they were fertilizing eggs and inserting them into the coral. And they were actually, and so I was like, okay, this is kind of, this is pretty wild. I've never seen anything like this. And then you start getting photos and images of like them actually inserting the eggs into the coral. And then once you build up some trust with them, you're able to get probably from as close as you are to your microphone is how close I got to them.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, this is really cool. This is really something. And so you start actually, so I started, you know, started getting into that. And what's really funny is that I left all my settings. I'd wash my camera off and I'd wash my camera off with fresh water after every dive. And I'd leave the camera exactly the way it was. And this is like one of those things where you make mistakes. So what happened was salt got corroded into the camera so much, or into like the some of the adjustments where you'd actually move the bars or whatever, that I couldn't actually move them anymore because they were corroded with salt. And I had to get other pieces of equipment and I had other people help me like take it all apart, reassemble it, and all this stuff. So you make 1,000 mistakes. And that's really how you learn, you know? And so I started actually I went to these workshops and I started learning how to shoot macro photography. Macro photography is like really small stuff, like really small stuff. And the thing is that what, you know, what's great about macro photography is you can take a picture of something really small. And if you screw up, you're like, all right, hold on a second. He's not going to move. So I can make an adjustment on the camera. Now, when you go to wide angle, like with a great white, you can't just tell the great white, hey, just stay right there. I got to change my camera here for a second. You know, and I kind of went to that story with that when I was talking, when I was telling you the story about that girl. She's making all those adjustments on her camera. Yeah. And this big, huge gray white behind her is like popping up. And I'm like, you have no idea what's behind you right now. But it's like the one that got away for her. But I was just like, man, I just like to tell her, just stay down for a second. So I just get that camera right in front of that shark's face.
Were you able to capitalize on that and get a picture of the shark, or was
she? I wasn't able to do it that time, but there was another time I was able to do it. So there was a buddy of mine. We kind of became friends on the boat, and he was sitting there, and we were, and the shark was kind of swimming up towards the surface, and I put my hand on his shoulder. He knew exactly what to do. He ducked real quick. I shot my camera out of the cage right at him, and just that one moment it came out perfect.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
you don't get those opportunities sometimes. Sometimes they're missed. And the thing is, you don't think about the great thing about photography, underwater photography, is it's you versus you. You're never in competition with someone else. You're always thinking about what can I do better? What can I do better with a better shot? And I think the wide angle stuff, I think about like I wasn't comfortable with my lighting and I really didn't know my strobes. And there was a manta ray that swam completely right over me, probably like 3 feet.
No.
And I just didn't have the strobes on. And I'm just like thinking to myself, oh my gosh, that photo. I could have got that. It was so fantastic. You know, but you don't think about all the great stuff you took, you know?
Yeah.
Because you're running to the horizon. When you're shooting photography, you're running to the horizon. You're always trying to like You're never going to get there, but you always want to just keep trying to get better.
Yeah.
It's you versus you.
It seems like it would have to be, because I mean, from what I know about wildlife photography on land, that is extremely difficult from all the reasons why you mentioned, just not having everything completely set up to capture the split second image or perfect that you get. But then with underwater photography, you've got none of that goes away, but then you're in a completely different foreign element with extra equipment. It just seems like, yeah, it would be extremely difficult to get so proficient at it that you can catch multiple images all the time.
Well, the thing is, no one thinks about too, like, you got to keep all the equipment around you working properly so you can breathe and survive the dive, right?
Yep. Yeah.
You know, so you got to, like, you'd be like, yeah, check your regulator, making sure, like, okay, what's my bottom time? How long can I stay down at this depth? Is that an issue? You know, my dive camera's beeping. Okay, I got to get up, you know, and you got to factor in air consumption and where everyone else is in the water.
Yep.
You know, because I mean, other people are like, oh man, I've already seen this, Rob. Let's keep diving. And I'm still there taking photos.
Yeah.
But one of the worst things you want to do is when you take a photo and you look up and no one's around.
Yeah.
You're like, oh God, where's the dive group at? I'm like, oh no. You know, that kind of stuff. But you know, I'm kind of like one of those guys when I was like, I'll take a risk, but it's got to be a calculated risk. So when I like did the thing with the sharks, I looked into it pretty extensively. Ronnie Fox, Great White Shark Expeditions down there in southern Australia, they've been doing it. They were filming Jaws and stuff in the 70s. So they've perfected that cage. So if like that cable wire is super strong, if that cable wire, you know, ever something got tangled up or messed up, they got like an apparatus. They got like this air system in there where the cage can come up on its own.
Okay. Protocols
and all that stuff. It isn't like just some rusty cage, you know, in Mexico where they're just going to dump you in the water and be like, all right, good luck, buddy.
Yeah.
This has actually been well thought out. They've been doing this for a long time. They got an entire crew on the boat that takes care of you. They got people down in the cage taking care of you. They got, you know, they cater your food and they got a cook and all that stuff. So it's you know, it's nothing. It's first rate. It's top of the line, you know. And what's crazy is that's really the only place in the world where you can actually dive with great whites right now.
I was going to ask about that. So South Africa isn't like the premier destination for that.
You used to be able to. Now, I don't know. This might the currents might have changed and stuff. But there was a point in time where you could actually be on the surface and be on the cage in South Africa. And then there was a combination of two things that happened. A lot of overfishing in that area actually pulled a lot of fish out of that area, which drove some of the sharks out of the area. There was also a series of killer whales that were coming in, taking out some great whites.
Hmm.
And so I've heard from Andrew Fox, who's Ronnie Fox's son. He's around our age. He told me that if a great white is attacked by a killer whale, they said that they will not actually be in that area for a full year.
Oh, wow. They get so spooked. They just move on.
They'll take off. Yeah. So South Africa didn't have a lot of great whites for an extensive period of time. I'm talking years. And then in Guadalupe, Mexico, they had a bunch of cages and then big great whites coming in there. But for some reason, the federal government, I don't know the details of it, but the federal government actually came in and said, hey, look, we're not doing any more of that great white stuff.
Yeah.
So the only place you can go now is in southern Australia with Rodney Fox.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Mexico was probably the concern you mentioned. They just had too many people getting sent down like in a fruit basket or something.
Well, I think in Guadalupe, they do a pretty good job. It's kind of like they were doing a pretty good job with it. There was like no rusty cages or anything like that. But what I'm saying is like sometimes, you know, somewhat dive operations, they're kind of like, yeah, we'll take you out there. I'm like, okay, have you done this before? You know, I mean, I want to make sure that, you know, you've done it before, you know. So I think sometimes I hear crazy stories of boat dive operations in the Philippines. This has happened before where they actually forget divers.
Wow.
And they're in the water and they get drifted by the current for like a couple days.
Yeah.
And then somehow they were found. It's like, man,
there's
no way. You know, I'm making sure that where I'm going, everything is, you know, top of the line, super safe, everything's secure and all that stuff. But, you know, everywhere I've gone, you know, stuff that, you know, you do full time, stuff that I'm doing full time. This is what some of these guys are doing over there full time. All they're doing is they're your guide and they are there to help you find what you're looking for in terms of your photography stuff. And these guys are, I mean, it's amazing what they can actually find. They can actually feel like, I remember one time I was in Bali. We were under this fishing pier and underneath this fishing pier, there is so much. And all of a sudden there was this huge rush of current of water where the temperature actually dropped like 7 degrees, like in 10 seconds, got crazy cold really fast. The dive guy kind of puts me to the side and just puts his hands out. It's like he's like sensing like something. There's this huge rush of schools of thousands of fish come sweeping underneath the pier, and there's two dolphins right there chasing them. And then as soon as they came, they're gone. And it's like, how did you even sense that? You know, it's like, well, what's going on there? How did you even figure out like that was even happening?
Yeah, yeah. What
you feel better with those guys in the water.
Oh yeah, definitely. If you've got somebody that devotes that much time and knows the area, I'm sure that can make the complete difference in what you find, what you see, all of that. Having that local expertise. I was going to ask, so out of all the different places you've been and the different animals you've seen under the ocean, what is probably the most fascinating from, since you've dealt with octopus, sharks, eel, like, is there anything that like you would put at the top of your list as far as if you could just know that you could go down and be taking pictures of them for an afternoon, what would be your top pick?
Probably an octopus.
Yeah. They seem extremely fascinating.
Yeah, because the octopus, their intelligence is so high. You don't know. Like my last dive before I actually flew back to the United States, I was able to hang out with an octopus for 45 minutes. And he kind of just sat there with me. And I was able to, I couldn't feel his hand because I had my gloves on and stuff. But I was just like, just hanging out with him. He was just sitting right next to me.
Yeah.
It was almost like he was like, he had his one arm, and he was just like feeling my arm, my glove, and that kind of stuff. And I just took a bunch of photos with him for about, you know, probably between 30 and 40 minutes. And he was just there. He was just there with me. It was like, it was amazing because it's like you see some of these documentaries like My Octopus Teacher and stuff on Netflix and that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, I see it all the time. When you're out in the Pacific, if you're in the right spot, here's the thing. If they want a photo and they want to hang out with you, they're going to hang out with you. And if they don't want nothing to do with you, they're gone.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really nothing else to it. Like even here locally, if you look at like, if you go up to the springs and you're dealing with manatees, and so those manatees, you know, everyone thinks they're like, oh, they're like real big, chubby, real super slow. No, they take off like torpedoes. If they don't want to be around you and they're not photogenic for the day and stuff, and they want to eat CRS, they're gone. They just take off.
Yeah.
So you got to take what the ocean gives you, you know?
How far do you typically go down? Like most of what I would think the most striking photography, like on coral reefs and stuff, isn't that far down, right? That's probably only like 30 feet or so.
Yeah. Some of the best stuff's probably between like 30 and 45 feet.
Okay.
That's usually where that's where most of the best stuff is. Now, if you want to get like some rare stuff, you might have to go get like a pygmy seahorse is the smallest seahorse in the world. They only get like, I don't know, like 3 centimeters. So they might get like an inch. They might get an inch tall.
Okay.
Most of them are about half an inch tall. Sometimes you got to go down to 90 feet for those guys.
Oh, wow.
If you're at 90 feet with water, with air consumption, you're only going to be there for a couple minutes.
Yep.
But you can do mixed gas. You can actually get more higher oxygen in your tank. Can give you a little bit longer time to be with them, but you only got a couple minutes.
Yeah.
And you got to go. But most of your good stuff is between, in my opinion, 30 and 45 feet, really.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it.
Everyone's so driven to go deep, deep, deep. But a lot of the good stuff is really, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, even at 50 feet, you're not really seeing as much.
Because most of the coral reefs and all of that that the fish feed off of is driven by sunlight still, right? Like where.
Yeah.
So the whole ecosystem can't get down that far until you get super deep. And then you're just talking about like freakish monsters living somewhere.
Yeah.
Down.
I mean, yeah. Now you're looking at, you got to be in a complete submersible there, right? Cause you're not going to be able to get down that deep for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah. I heard there's a crazy story and I don't even know if it's true or not. This is before I even got on the island that there was, you know, people that identify things that are coming from the deep and they're not really sure if they exist. You know, they're like, did I just see what I was supposed to see? Like, I'll give you an example. So like where I was is that you got the Mariana Trench, which is like one of the deepest parts of the ocean that have existed. And then up next to it is the Ryukyu Trench, which is, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's Ryukyu Trench. And so that's actually not as deep, but still really deep.
Yeah.
And then you get closer northwest, now you're getting into the islands of Japan. And you never know what's coming in from like the deep, you know, at night. Because what happens is little stuff wants to get other little stuff to eat. And then it's just that chain reaction.
Yeah.
So everyone's coming in from the ocean at the deep to come in at night. But anyway, there's a story that I heard. And I don't know if it's true or not, but there was these two divers and they're on the east side of the island. So this is like there's a little bit more current. There's a little more action in terms of bigger pelagic stuff potentially swimming through. When I say bigger pelagic stuff, we're talking about whales, sharks, bigger things that would actually migrate up and down the Pacific. And these two divers were diving and they heard some scratching. And the scratching was actually they couldn't make like what is this noise that's happening? And they went around the corner about the end of their dive. They've been in the water for about, I don't know, probably at least 40 minutes. And so they hear this scratching and they go around the corner and it is a extremely large squid that is sharpening or scratching his beak his tentacles on the rocks.
Ugh.
And they're kind of looking at him, and then the squid kind of looks at them and kind of postures himself. And we're talking something that's very large. We're talking about, you know, right. I mean, you know, it's kind of like then he actually he sharpens his beak and he kind of stops and postures, looks at him, and then with one big foul swoop just kind of propels himself away from them. And then the water that pulled that was so powerful that propelled him, knocked the divers back like 3 feet.
Wow.
Because it was just so powerful. Now, how much of that story is true or not, I don't know. That was the story that I was told when I got to the island. And so there's an old saying, if you didn't get photos, it didn't exist.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, you know, one of those things, right?
That's what didn't they think that giant squid were completely extinct until just recently, like within the past, I want to say decade or two, that they discovered that they're
starting marking on whales.
Yeah. And they've had I think they've had a couple of dead bodies wash up somewhere in Japan or something like that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was saying. Like when you get into the pelagic, you know, current and stuff, that's actually going from those deep areas and it's going all up into the Japan coast. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff there that hasn't been undocumented. So there's a lot of stuff out there that you don't know if it, you know, how often it's there. Because, I mean, it's hard to get out there, number one. It's so remote. I mean, to fly there from here, like if I wanted to go to Bali from here and I wanted to get, like, some of those places, I mean, you're looking at, with connecting flights, probably over 40 hours.
Wow.
So it's just, it takes a long time to get out. And if you want the good places, you got to go, it's got to be remote. It's got to be a place where there's not a whole lot of people.
Yeah. That's it. Like, I think a lot of people don't get how big, like from the traveling I've done, and I've done a good bit of like outdoor backpacking, kind of backcountry camping and stuff. And most people don't have a good sense for how large everything is, how vast wilderness can be, how big the earth actually is. And then when you throw in the oceans, which dwarfs any of the land, it's just, it's crazy to think like what could be out there that just doesn't come in contact.
So what's crazy about the Pacific is so huge. It's like half the world. People don't realize that. People don't realize this, and I learned this from a marine biologist at one of the workshops, is that the Pacific is actually getting smaller, and the Atlantic is actually getting bigger.
Hmm.
So what's happening is the Atlantic is actually separating out, and what's happening in the Pacific is the tectonic plates of all the land masses are all colliding together, and that's why you see tsunamis, that's why you see earthquakes, and that's why you see all those tremors and everything that's happening over in California and Alaska. You'll see, like, there'll be like signal towers and stuff in the middle of the Pacific, and those will ping off in Hawaii. They'll ping off in Japan to actually make sure that, you know, that we're alerted if anything happens in the water. Yeah. What's happening is that those land masses are colliding together, and they're creating this thing called subduction. And so when they collide together, they're actually building up into like these little pockets of sand or pockets of land, and they're creating these mini ecosystems everywhere in the Pacific. And that's where you're able to find all this really unique biodiversity over there.
Hmm. Interesting. Have you got any immediate plans to go on any new photography trips coming up? Anything scheduled? Well,
there's so many things you think about, things you want to do. But I think if I had I think one of the best places on this side of the world to dive is West Palm Beach.
Really?
So, West Palm Beach. And so what happens is that the Gulf of Mexico has this current that actually slingshots up the current, up the East Coast. And the point that actually jettisons furthest out of Florida that actually clips that Gulf current is actually West Palm Beach.
Hmm.
And so what happens is that warm water with the combination of that and the where it's geographically located, you can actually get some really, really cool stuff at really shallow depths over there. There's this thing called the Blue Heron Bridge. It's really popular over there where you get a lot of divers. And I hope as, like, you know, the pandemic's kind of subsided now and stuff, it's a lot easier now to get over there and dive, because when everything was going on with the pandemic, no one could go dive in anywhere else. I mean, there was more divers in there than there were fish. I mean, it was like, you know, when you're trying to take photos, you don't want to see that. You know?
Yeah.
If there's more bubbles than water, you don't want to be there.
Yeah.
But I think just from a local standpoint, I think West Palm Beach is probably the way to go. If I was going to do anything else, I would love to, if I was to upgrade my camera system, go over maybe over to where the Sea of Cortez is, where it's the Gulf of California. I think it'd be really cool to get out there and just do some snorkeling out there and see if you could get lucky and have a whale come by. Or I think it'd be really cool to snorkel with killer whales. That'd be really nerve wracking, but rewarding at the same time. If I had to go back over on the Pacific again, I think for sure what I would do is I would probably want to go back to Bali's probably one of my favorite places.
Okay. I was going to ask you that, where, location wise was the best so far.
Location wise, Bali, the combination of the atmosphere, the how chill and how relaxed it is, and all the diversity that's in the water and stuff. I think I really liked Bali. I've been there like 3 times.
Okay.
They have it's all black sand.
Mm.
And what's crazy is you'll walk down the beach and it looks exactly the same from the surface, but totally different layouts inside the water.
Huh.
Like these places called cleaning stations. And so in the book, there was this one photo. It's the only photo in the book that actually represents Bali. And so there was a big red grouper that was sitting at this cleaning station. And I'm like, why do they call it a cleaning station? But what happens is the fish know that if they go to these certain places where these rocks are, you've got all these little fish and little shrimp that are just sitting there waiting for the fish to come by, and they'll jump on them and they'll pick off everything in terms of like cleaning their skin,
yeah,
cleaning their scales and cleaning their gills and everything. And they'll just sit there. And so I was able to sit there for probably, it was probably a good hour. I sat in front of this grouper and he opened his mouth completely wide open, kind of get his gills to open up, and the shrimp was actually going around and cleaning his gills and everything. And I got this picture of the grouper wide, his mouth wide open, and the shrimp is actually in the center of the circle of his mouth, and he's just sitting there posing for me.
And the grouper doesn't eat it, allows him to just do his work.
Yeah, he just does his thing.
Yeah.
And he just kind of sits there. So it's like you're not going to get those photos other places.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and so I think like the pelagic stuff, the real big stuff, like in terms of stuff swimming by, like I'd love to get back down with Rodney Fox down and get some more great whites. I think that would be really, really cool. And I think because they're so accommodating, they're so cool with you and stuff like that. The other place where I learned to really shoot was in Analao, the Philippines. It's about 2.5 hour drive from Manila.
Okay.
And they'll actually, they do a really good job like hanging out with you and stuff. But there's another place that's another flight. It's a little bit more remote in the Philippines. It's called Dumaguete, or they have a section called Duwanan. And you can actually, during the day, one day, if you want to get like really small little things, you can take photos of those. And then if you want in the afternoon, you can take this really huge boat and take a 30 minute boat ride, and you can swim with giant sea turtles that are like over 300 pounds.
Oh, wow. That would be amazing.
Yeah. And so that's really fun. I mean, I love that. I'd love to get in the water with some manta rays again. That's kind of, manta rays are just so large, but they're so graceful and they're very inquisitive. They want to actually come up to you. They want to see what you're doing.
Huh?
So it's kind of cool. Like you see some stuff that just wants to hang out with you. You're like, okay, this isn't just like some dumb animal. This is actually someone that, you know, has the thought process. They think, they feel, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's now, I've never had an opportunity to get with a whale, but I would love to go to Tonga. Tonga is like, it's kind of like in the middle of nowhere. It's east. Like you think of like New Zealand is like, kind of like, you feel like Australia's in the middle of nowhere. And then you go east of Australia, and then you got New Zealand, and you're like, man, that's just the land before time.
Yeah.
And then east of that is Tonga, and that's where like you have migrating humpback whales that actually come down, and they'll actually bring their calves down there, and they kind of get used to shallower water, get used to just swimming, vomiting, and then as the year progresses, then they work their way north up to Alaska.
Okay.
But I would love getting in the water with those guys.
Yeah. That would be, but, yeah, it just seems like, if you've got the resources to do it and the time that, go into some of those incredibly remote locations. Like I've been to South America a few times and meant to go to the Galapagos Islands, which you go off the coast of Ecuador, I think it is.
Yeah, you got to know what you're doing when you're diving down there.
Yeah, I never made it. I wasn't going to dive. I'm licensed to scuba dive, but I've only done it like twice in my life. So, but I was just trying to get out there to see the wildlife, but it was such a time commitment to get over there that I couldn't end up doing it. Because, like you were saying before, some of those locations with the best wildlife, it's like, you got to spend an extra day just to get to them.
It's a lot of work. Just kidding. Like you got to get all your gear ready, and then you got to get on, you got prepared to get on a boat or something. And then you got to like get all that gear on. Then you got to make sure all the gear is working.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, now you got to dive.
Yep.
And then you dive, and then you get up in the boat, then you got to take all that gear off. You got to get all that. It's a lot of work, but you got to really love it if you're going to do something like that.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Rob, I appreciate you giving us the time. This was great. Very interesting. And before we run out of time, I was going to ask, like, can you let the audience know where to find your work, your book, social media, if you've got it, if they're interested in your photography?
Oh, yeah. You can go to kidstonphotography.com. It's KIDSTON photography.com. The name of the book on Amazon is Stories of the Ocean. And my name is Robert Kidston. And you can check that out. And I got a YouTube channel. And I'll have some videos that come out there. And it's Kidston Photography. And so I'll pump out some videos and shorts and that kind of stuff too while I'm there. But I think I appreciate you, Jim. You taking the time. Love telling you stories. Would love to tell you more. I can't believe where I went. We went to our time because I was thinking of like three or four more that we could actually talk about. But, you know, yeah. Time flies when you're actually getting into this stuff.
Yeah, it does go quick. Well, I definitely encourage you to call in any more to the show if you get a chance. And yeah, we appreciate you making the entry and spending the time to come by and talk to us further. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Thanks, Jim.
And that was the interview with February Story winner Rob Kidston, everybody. Hope you enjoy it and you check out Rob's book, Stories of the Ocean, and his photography on kidstonphotography.com. And most importantly, call in your own story. It doesn't matter what the topic is, what type of story it is, if it's creepy, if it's funny, if it's even questionably if it's true or not. We really don't care, just as long as it's entertaining. So call it in, go to the show notes to click on the links that allow you to quickly and easily send it to us through SpeakPipe, or you can also go to yourbesttruestory.com to enter your story. Few minutes work and you could win $250 and get interviewed on the show. Thanks a lot, and make sure to tune in for the next episode in a week or two, where we'll have more story entries being played for you. Thanks a lot. Bye bye.
Got a crazy ass true story to tell. It could be funny or thrilling or creepy as hell. And when you speak, surely none will make a sound. And the world's going breathless when your true story comes around. Oh, hear the crazy bullshit flying. Just one more, maybe, true story before we're dying. Yet be warned, surely not all stories will be treated the same. So don't blame us if your tale about Grandma's lame. The only way to ensure you could possibly win a buck is to make sure that story of yours don't suck. So instead of yawns, go ahead and tell us how that Bigfoot or werewolf drowned, and then hear the world go breathless when your true story comes around. Hear the crazy